You're listening to The Cultural Hall with your hosts, Richie T. Stedman and Ashley Garvey Smith. It's a show about Mormon stuff.
Nephi! Ella! Samuel! Give us land to live righteously!
That's right, it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, episode 26. We're going to be visiting, complete the word. I should go ahead and say the entire word instead of just visit.
Yes.
With Chris Heimerdinger, author of the Ten of Shoes, Among the Nephites series, and also Return to Christmas. So we'll ask him about it, everything like that. Also, a film director, Passage to Zarahemla.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, so we'll talk to him about that. That's coming up in the second and third block of the Cultural Hall. But it's me, Richie T. Stedman.
And Ashley Garby Smith.
And The Cultural Hall. You can find us online, theculturalhall.com. Find us on Facebook by searching The Cultural Hall. Do a favor. Let's do our missionary work here real quick. Let me take a missionary moment.
Okay. We need to do that every so often.
You know, a couple years ago, there was that story about you never know if your neighbors are going to like orange juice unless you offer them the orange juice. Remember that story?
No.
It was from a general conference where essentially the idea was that there was a guy had his, it's a fictional story, guy had his neighbor over, sat him down on the couch, and they're visiting, and there's this beautiful, you know, fresh squeezed pitcher of orange juice, and he has one cup, and he's there, you know, drinking the orange juice, visiting with the guy. He's like, oh, yeah, man, that's good. That's good orange juice. Takes another glass. Boy, that orange juice is so fantastic. And then the parable that they talk about is, you know, the guy didn't want to share his orange juice because he didn't want to offend the guy by offering him this delicious orange juice. and then related it back to the gospel, how if we love it so much and if it's so fantastic, why aren't we sharing the gospel with other people? And so I always remember that. Not very many people remember it. I always make references to it, and everyone always gives me the what you just
gave
me.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So do us a favor here on the Cultural Hall, and if you like what you hear, you've enjoyed listening to the different shows, all the different theme shows, everything like that, in addition to contacting us and letting us know what it is that you'd like or what you'd like to hear more of, share us with your friends.
Yes.
And there, I have been surprised with the people that have contacted me saying, you know what? I am a Jack Mormon. I have no intention of going back to church. But thank you for the podcast and the show. Thank you for the Cultural Hall. It allows me to know what's going on. It allows me, you know, an opportunity to see maybe how the church has progressed a little bit in some thought. It gives an insight to things that I would have never thought of because I've been away from the church for so long, or just that I didn't think of.
Yeah. And you don't have to even be a member to listen to the Cultural Hall.
No. Well, actually, I'm kidding.
You do not have to be a member to listen to the Cultural Hall. So let even your friends that are not members know about us.
Just tell them, you know, if they're, I don't know why I'm saying you know so much. I think Rob from Articles of News is rubbing off on me. But let them know that it's here. Let them follow us on Facebook. We have a new kind of initiative in the last couple of weeks about making sure that we post more often the stories that we feel like are important, that people should know about, funny cartoons and comics. It's a community where if you want to know what is going on, what the mind of the Mormon culture is, it's the Cultural Hall.
Yeah, and it's super simple. Once you see that we post an episode on the Cultural Hall on Facebook or on theculturalhall.com, then you can just hit the share button and put it on your Facebook page. It's super simple.
You can subscribe to it on iTunes too.
Yes.
Should mention that. And two, if you subscribe to the Cultural Hall on iTunes, do us a favor and write a review. The way that iTunes works is it's just essentially a system of how many downloads you get and then how many people review it and review it positively. And the more people that download it and the more people that review it positively, we get kind of a higher ranking. I don't care about the rank. The rank's not the big deal. But the one positive thing that a rank does is it allows more people to see it.
Right.
Because it moves up and people go, the Cultural Hall, haven't heard of that. But 120 people like it, have said very favorable things about it. And 7,000 people downloaded that last episode. I want to find out, you know, what that is. I want to listen to it. And then they can share it with their friends. And then they tell two people.
And then they tell two people. Yes. And, you know, we can take constructive criticism as well.
Please.
So let us know what we could be doing better. And
I'll take deconstructive criticism.
We'll take
as well.
Any criticism.
Yeah,
at all.
If you're just like Richie, so I hate you. I'd take it, but you have to tell me why you hate me.
Yeah, give us a reason and let us know what we can do better.
Yeah, it's just like a calling. We're new.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you ever been fired from a calling?
You know, I don't know that I've ever been fired, but I'll tell you this incident. One time, I was in a singles ward, and I was called as the ward choir recruiter.
Oh yes, that is a great calling.
I didn't have to be a part of the choir. I just had to get people to go to the choir. That was my calling.
But were you a part of the choir?
Yeah, I was.
Okay,
but
sure.
They made it very clear. You don't have to sing. You just have to get people to go to the ward choir.
Okay.
And so I was like, man, how am I going to, okay, I got it. So how it worked in that particular ward is sacrament meeting would get over, and then everyone would come up, you know, they'd say the closing prayer, and everyone would get up and say their announcements. We're having a linger longer today. Come in this delicious potato bar. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And then it was like, and Tuesday night we'll be playing Ultimate Frisbee, where everyone will take it far too serious and hurt other people. And Thursday night, all the men of the ward will be playing NBA basketball, or at least in their minds they'll be playing NBA basketball.
Exactly.
And so I would get up and do announcements as part of that. Well, I really liked it. I really liked that portion, because what I would do is every week I would come up with a different kind of way that I could tell people the benefits of joining the ward choir.
For example?
I did a top 10 list one time.
Oh,
top
nice.
10 reasons why you should join the ward choir. And though I don't remember all of them, I remember one that was like, you can get a write-off on your tithing, so you only have to pay 9%.
That is not true.
No, and it's not true. But it got a lot of that response, and people then started looking forward to
what
the announcement of what I was doing and not really cared so much about the choir. I remember another time there was a guy in the ward who sounded, and I wish I could remember his name, the guy who does music in the spoken word.
Oh, yeah.
It's brother whoever
right.
is his name. And his voice sounded exactly like him. And I was like, this is great. I need you to do me a favor. And so I had him come up onto the stand with me, and I said, brothers and sisters, I had the most amazing dream last night, and this is what I remember hearing. And I had this whole script for him to read out, and it's like, ladies and gentlemen, from the crossroads of the West, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, accompanied by the Riverside Ninth Ward, or Riverview Ninth Ward, the ward that I was in, and Gladys Knight, without the pips, and you know, just this big ridiculous thing. And he sounded exactly like it. And people were just rolling. And then I was dismissed from having that calling anymore. I think I did about 9 or 10 announcements. And they gave me another calling. I ended up being a teacher immediately after that. But
you were too enthusiastic.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, and I said this recently. I said, a lot of times in the church, we expect people to do things for free and then we complain about the way that they are doing things.
Right.
So just remember that when you are murmuring against someone, that when we have callings, we all do it voluntarily. And sometimes we do a good job. And sometimes it just takes a little bit of work and effort. Yeah. So.
And P.S., we're not getting paid for this cultural hall thing.
Yeah.
So if you don't like it, you know.
You expect us to do this for free and then you complain about us.
However, if you would like to advertise on the Cultural Hall, go ahead and contact us at theculturalhall.com. We'd love to help you or your business or your friend's business, your family business.
Yes.
Business you don't even know about. If you want to pay for them to have a commercial, you bet.
Yeah.
We'll do that. But that's all can be contacted through theculturalhall.com. I guess the only other thing that I wanted to talk about is do you go to church every Sunday?
I actually do. I go to church.
Regardless?
Oh, are we talking about
like
vacationing?
Vacation or like husband is sick and stays home? Do you stay home with husband?
No, I don't. And my husband actually will not stay home if I'm sick. My husband is amazing and he always goes to church. But we do go to church. We have a cabin up in Island Park, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And we do go to church when we are up at the cabin. But usually when we're on vacation, we don't necessarily make it a priority, although we should.
Why not? Why do you not do it?
Just because we don't make it a priority, I think.
Right.
I think like if we're in Lake Powell, we don't make it a priority to get off the boat and go find a church.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is something that you have to plan ahead and make a priority. So if we're in Island Park at the cabin, yes, we do go. But other places,
well,
maybe not necessarily.
And probably because you feel comfortable because you've been there enough that it's
right.
Like, oh, we know we're going to be here a couple Sundays this summer. We'll
exactly.
Go up there. Oh, it's you guys are back. Oh, yeah, our thing's down in Utah. You bet they're fantastic.
Yeah, it's,
so good
it's
to
a
see.
Comfortable place to be, yes. I think that's part of it.
See, and for me, I will always go to at least sacrament meeting. And if it were up to me, I'd go to the entire block.
Really?
But that's kind of been a concession that I've made.
Right.
In that... you know, it's uncomfortable for people, especially the third block. You know, you have
yes.
Sunday school where everyone's still all together, but then the third block, your priesthood and your relief society, it's like, okay, yeah, I was a little sweet talking to get you to stay this long anyway. Now go be by yourself where I'm going to go do this. But I absolutely love it.
Do you?
I think that it's so fascinating. I probably don't love it like for the gospel, you know, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do feel that and I have a great testimony of the church. I kind of like it just to absorb kind of the feeling of whatever community that is.
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea.
And being in a ward and seeing how the church, it kind of is one of those things where it reaffirms my testimony. I go, man, this is cool
mm-hmm.
that it's you know,
it's
same as it is at home.
Yep.
And then sometimes, too, the difference is where I'm like, this is different.
It is. You know, I lived in South Carolina for 5 years, and it is a little different. In certain places.
Out in South Carolina, did you get that mm-hmms when
we
people would
the
bear their testimonies?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yes, we did. And I loved it. I loved it.
Or like the people that talk back when people are bearing their testimony and then, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And you're like, wait, why isn't everyone being quiet?
Are we supposed to do that? Yeah. When you're coming from Utah and you go somewhere else outside of Utah,
you're used to quiet.
You are, yes. Yeah, but I loved it. I loved the church. Out there. So, and it is the same. You learn the exact same thing. It's just different people and it's
mm-hmm.
great. It is great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Amen.
Yes, you said it. That was my favorite too. You said it. I remember that first experience that I had when I was on my mission in Cleveland and someone started talking back to the talker. I'm like, shh.
Are you supposed to do that?
And then I was like, yeah, you bet.
Yes,
I will reaffirm that. Uh-huh. And I never let it get out of control, but certainly it was fun to, yes, you bet.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You tell him. So, anyway, coming back in the second block here of the Cultural Hall, visiting with Chris Heimerdinger, the author of the Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites series. He's a musician. He's a movie maker.
Director. Yes. He's amazing.
Script writer, book writer. He's the man. It's Chris Heimerdinger coming back in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5500. To book your shoot today.
That's right. It's the second block of the Cultural Hall. And joining us here in the Cultural Hall, Chris Heimerdinger. Thank you so much for taking part of your day and spending time with us here in the Cultural Hall.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, my favorite part with Chris is, as I was speaking with him to arrange this interview, he volunteered to do this pretty blindly. I said, hey, you know what? Will you be on this? I contacted him through Facebook, and he's like, yeah, you bet. You bet I will. And as I was talking to him earlier today, I realized I hadn't really told him much about what the Cultural Hall is or, you know.
No, sorry. I feel culturally ignorant.
No, you're fine. Well, now once you know and then you tell the world, then everyone will know.
That's right.
Everyone will know. It's got to be a part of the plot of some book that's got great mystery to it. So
yeah.
We'll do that in the future.
Everyone will know.
All right. That's been recorded, so I'm taking that down, Chris. If that's not
okay.
If that's not part of a book in the future, let me tell you the experience that I have with Chris Heimerdinger. Two things. One, I want to say it was maybe a gift when I turned 8 years old, or maybe it was a gift when I turned 12 years old. But I remember receiving the first book of Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites from my grandmother for some sort of like religious aged holiday.
Right.
You know, eight or 12. And I remember getting the book and looking at it and going, what?
Tennis shoes.
Nephites. That doesn't seem like that.
Yeah, that's 8 years old would be a very precocious child. I'd say probably most of the kids who are starting my books are around 10, 11. It depends on how good of a reader they are. But, you know, every time I go to an autograph party and somebody comes up to me and says, now, what age group are these for? I say, man, I don't know. I just write the kind of books that I like to read. It's interesting that, and if you've read more than just the first book in the Tennis Shoe series, that's the only book where the protagonists are even 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
The protagonists are adults in many of the Tennis Shoe series, but it's always because maybe of the word tennis shoes, I don't know. It's always kept the persona of being a children's series, and that's fine. I'm not going to tell. I think youth do more reading than adults maybe sometimes, or they're more into fantasy adventure. So I'm certainly not going to tell youth not to buy it, but I don't think somebody 80 years old has ever complained or felt like they were left out.
Well, and I remember reading the book, too. So I got the book,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites, thanks, Grandma, right? Because, you know, I didn't know. Up to that point in my life, I hadn't been, I was kind of neutral religious, you know,
right.
Mom was kind of, meh, and Dad was like, yeah. But I hadn't done much reading really either besides the stuff that was out of school. And I remember picking up and reading Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites. And as you said, you know, everyone in the book, they're kind of my age, you know, and it's this fantastic adventure where they travel back. If you haven't read the Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites books, or at least know what they're about, you need to check it out. And I'm sure we'll expound on that a little bit. But I remember, you know, they travel back and it's this fantastical story where they're traveling into the land of the Nephites. And it's just like, holy crap, this is cool. And it put it in a way for me that as a, I guess I assume now I must have been about 11 or 12 year old kid going, oh, yeah, okay.
So it helps you understand that time period a little bit better.
Yeah. So these are people from the scriptures. These are when I go and read the scriptures. You know, it's fiction, certainly, but it certainly is based on these people that I'd read about. Let me ask you, Chris, how did you come up with that idea?
Oh, this is going to sound kind of corny, but the very first Tennis Shoes book, I've only had two books like this, but the first Tennis Shoes book was actually based on a dream that I had when I was on my mission in Gainesville, Florida, of all places, in like 1985. I just had this dream about these kids going back in time and meeting the heroes of the Book of Mormon. And I know that the dream involved Frost Cave. That was a cave that I used to explore when I was a kid in Cody, Wyoming. It's a real place called Crystal Caverns, Frost Cave. And exactly the way it's described in the book, you have to go to the BLM and get a special key in order to even get into it, because they don't like to send rescue missions down in there to try to get people out.
Uh-huh.
That was the basis of the story. And then when I got home from my mission, I tried to write it for a year or two, and then I finally got married, and I suppose that helped me to settle down in mind and heart enough to sit down and complete it. So I completed it when I was about 24 years old. Which is longer ago than I'm going to talk about. But that's when I completed the Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites, and it was picked up by the first publisher that I sent it to, who was LDS, an LDS publisher, which was Covenant Communications, which is now part of the Deseret Book conglomerate. And it's helped me pay my bills ever since.
And that's a pretty big step, because there weren't a lot of things like that. I mean, we look at it now and there's The Work and the Glory,
right.
That is that, you know, not similar in, you know, Work and Glory is talking about the pioneers and everything like that, but similar in this kind of fictitious look at history. You know, they probably took a pretty big leap with you, and like you say, it's paid off and been able to pay your bills since then.
You know, that's true. Let me back up just a minute, because I did call even a bigger publisher than Covenant Communications at the time, which was called Bookcraft, which is now, again, part of Deseret Book. But anyway, I called them and I said, hey, I have this story about time travel, adventures, Book of Mormon. And they actually showed no interest. They said, we're not interested in the fictionalization of Book of Mormon characters or time periods. We'd rather just deal with the scriptures themselves. And I thought, huh. And, you know, in my mind and growing up and, of course, being part of the Spielberg generation within Star Wars generation, it's like I always thought that these things made you hyper-interested in those kinds of things. If you could make an adventure out of it, then you'd find kids going back and finding the source materials and studying sharks, you know, like they did with Jaws, or being into science fiction like they were with Star Wars. And so I wasn't hindered by that at all. And I went to another publisher, and they picked it up. And I mean, no, it's interesting that up to that time, nobody had really dealt with time travel in the Book of Mormon. Since then, there's been, I think, a number of LDS authors that have explored that, and I say more power to them. I mean, welcome. Anything at all, really, that celebrates the Book of Mormon and hopefully points people back to the scriptures themselves is worth being written.
Twilight, right?
Yeah, well, the youth of our generation, we want to be excited about being a Latter-day Saint, about that identity, that self-identity. And you're right, I think. When you're 11 or 12 years old, you've kind of just been living your whole life based on the experience of your parents, and they drag you to church every Sunday. And I know I joined the church when I was 18 years old, and it was an incredible conversion. I don't know that I have an incredible conversion story. It was just simply, I read the Book of Mormon, I prayed to know whether it was true, and I got an answer.
Oh, sure, the easy way. Okay.
Yeah, but I remember the mindset change as a result of that. It's like you'd look at a tree differently. Being a Latter-day Saint was so exciting, and I remember I was at BYU when I was baptized, so after that I went on a mission about maybe a year and maybe 2 years after I was baptized. And during that 2 years, I consumed all of the religion credits that I would need to get at BYU in order to graduate. And as a result, took, you know, New Testament, Doctrine and Covenants, everything. Couldn't get enough of it. And I'm still that way. I'm still fascinated by the gospel. It's like we only maybe have a small piece more than the rest of the world, other Christians, but that piece is everything. It involves the authority to actually perform priesthood functions, and I mean, I was excited about that, and I'm still excited about that, and I hope it comes through in my works, and that, you know, that can get other people excited about the culture, the religion that they're a part of.
Let's go back a little bit, though, because if I'm understanding you correctly, I know you were born in Indiana.
Right.
But you went to BYU for
school. Well, I was born in Bloomington, Indiana. Uh-huh. My father has a PhD in theater and speech, okay? So that's probably where I get some of those. And he's a writer. And so, and my great-grandfather published books, even to the point where in the silent movie era, they made a movie out of one of his books. and we have a copy of that.
What is it called?
Very old. It was called Under the 4-H Flag, and his name was John Case, and he was actually a newspaper editor in St. Joseph, Missouri. And in fact, I have an aunt who published thrillers, and she did them, and she's passed away recently, but she did them under the name of John Case, because at the time she felt like you had to have a male name in order to publish thriller novels. So anyway, the whole bug of writing stories certainly, and writing runs in the family. But after my parents divorced when I was about 4 years old, and my mother got remarried and moved to Cody, Wyoming when I was in about the second grade. And so most of my childhood memories, adventures, are all based on that part of the world. I mean, the love of nature and the love of just mountains and the sculptures of the Wapiti Valley. It was a beautiful location to have a childhood, and so I think it became a natural setting for many of my stories.
And how much did you know about the LDS Church growing up, since you weren't a member, but you did know about BYU, obviously?
I did have some friends in high school or in junior high and even in grade school who were LDS. And I remember there were a couple times when they'd approached me, because I used to go over to the LDS Church Seminary building at lunch, and I would play ping pong, right?
Yeah,
we would do round robin ping pong.
That's how we
go
get
around
them.
The table.
That's how we get people. We have a great ping pong table and a great pool table.
At least that's how they got me to the point of, I suppose, feeling like I was free to try to go to BYU, because I did not have a very good back then, as today, ACTs and SATs were a very big part of how you get into BYU.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I think my cumulative, when I got out of high school, because I took a lot of basket weaving classes. I guess they wouldn't be basket weaving, but all my electives were things like we had a high school radio station, and,
hey,
and I took journalism, and I took photography, and things which were not physics, that were not math, that were not science. And so as a result, although I did love history, and maybe that was my highest GPA score, or ACT score, but I had a cumulative about 18, and I think that BYU has incredibly high standards of getting in now, and I think that back in those days, there must have been some kind of quota for non-members, and I was a non-member, and so they let me in. And I did fine. I mean, I got about a 3.4 grade average during the years that I was there, but then I was a BYU dropout. I never graduated because I became convinced shortly after my mission that a degree in the arts really didn't do much for you. You had to really show your stuff out in the real world and make an impact.
Yeah, no one ever goes, I have a degree in theater arts, and no, I don't think that anyone has ever asked me, you know, you were really great in that cold read right there, and that guy was really good in that cold read. Either of you have your bachelor's degree? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, exactly, although I'm sure that it was your theater experience which is aiding you in what you're doing right now.
Absolutely.
So. Yeah.
And same with me. I mean, all of the theater experience and just getting to know people and getting a love for the arts that you need in high school or in college. And I say that the best courses I took in college as far as becoming a writer was things like American heritage or biology. And I try and tell that to people who want to become a writer. It's like they say, what should I study? What kind of writing courses should I take? And I say, do anything but take writing courses. I mean, you want to learn how to write, just be a reader. Just read. You'll understand the art form after a while. But what's most important is that you have something to say, something to write about. And you're not going to get that by studying creative writing courses or even literature classes. I mean, you might find out who your competition is, Shakespeare or Dickens or somebody like that. But, you know, really, you need to find out what's going on in the marketplace now. You have to be able to feed your family. Big part of being an artist. And so familiarize yourself with what's hot and what's selling in the real world. And then use that knowledge, that information, to determine what you're going to write about, what kind of stories you're going to tell. And, you know, obviously I'm a Latter-day Saint. That's a big part of who I am. So it's impossible to escape that identity when I write stories.
So, Chris, I mean, certainly very devout. I mean, you can hear your devotion to the church at this point. But I'm still not sure that I get how it came to be that you are a member of the church. You went from Cody, you got into BYU and said, yeah, this seems like a good idea. Was it a friend that you had there at BYU? Or how? Because I would assume that even being surrounded by Mormon people at BYU, you'd still have to have someone go, here's a book and here's how this would go about if you want to know this is true. Or you know, how did that happen?
Oh, I must have had 50 people. So this was the late 70s, early 80s, okay? And I must have had 50 people come up and bear their testimony to me. I mean, this was just the corny thing that Latter-day Saints did all day long. and we don't do that today. We don't do that today the way that we used to. In fact, I was interested in looking up the statistics a few years ago, and I realized that the year I was baptized, 1981, we had almost 300,000 convert baptisms.
Oh, wow.
And we had just passed the 5 million mark as far as membership in the church. Last year, with almost 15 million members, we had 300,000 convert baptisms with twice as many missionaries in the field. So what does that tell you about maybe some changes we ought to make about just being courageous enough to just bear our testimony? It used to bug me to death. These people didn't say, I believe my church is true. They said, I know my church is true. And that bugged me because they were sincerely convinced that I could receive a revelation, literally, telling me that their religion was the true religion on the face of the earth. And it's like, well, you know, it was interesting that it was during the period of time, I suppose, that some of my friends were bearing their testimony to me, that I somehow gained a testimony of the Savior. And I was in high school when that happened. And That was probably the influence of Baptists, of some of the Baptists in my high school that helped me to gain that testimony. And so I'll always be grateful to that. But it was while I was at BYU that I took a Book of Mormon course, and as a result of that, you got to read the Book of Mormon, my very first semester. And I knew what was coming. When I was done, I knew about the promise in Moroni 10:3-5. And I decided I was, when that moment came that I finished the book, I was going to fast and pray exactly the way these Mormon people are telling me to do it.
So
just see what happens.
So you went into it knowing, okay, this is how I know this is going to end? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I didn't know that it would end with receiving anything.
But you know,
with actually receiving an answer.
Yeah.
In some ways, I think it's a good thing I was 18 years old. You know, we get more prideful every year of our lives as far as thinking we know everything and nothing can change us. And at 18 years old, I guess I didn't have all these preset conditions about what an experience with the Holy Ghost was going to be. I mean, nobody had described it. Some people had said things like burning in the bosom. I mean, I think there's a reason that we can't describe perfectly what the Holy Ghost is as far as a physical experience or even an emotional experience, because it's the universal teacher of the universe, and we can't, we're not supposed to, I think, be able to put that into a perfect word description. And the universal truth teller, so that it, and balancer of mankind. It's what makes somebody who's a PhD physics professor, puts them on the exact same plane as a burger flipper, okay? Someone who flips burgers for a living or is in the most menial job that you can think of. That person has exactly the same access to the ultimate intelligence of the universe as Einstein. And really, in the end, when we measure what true intelligence, in God's definition, what is intelligence, I think in the next life it's going to be a different definition. If somebody was president or a dictator or whatever, and their intelligence or their worldly intelligence gained them all the riches and success of the world, but they lived a pretty hedonistic life, and then we have a farmer who followed the gospel, obeyed the commandments, and receives the celestial kingdom. In the next life, who really was the most intelligent of the two? And so that's why I consider the Holy Ghost the great equalizer of humanity.
So
that was what I experienced at 18 years old. I actually received a confirmation, and it's difficult to describe. Burning in the bosom, I suppose. A tingling sense. I don't know. Everybody will describe it in a little bit different way. All I know is that pure intelligence came into my mind and my heart and confirmed that the Book of Mormon was true. And this was beyond, I guess, a whole lot of knowledge that I had. You know, when you're reading the scriptures the first time, I mean, your mind wanders. And I picked up a lot of it, but of course I missed so much more. And the second and third time I read the Book of Mormon, it was like I was reading it for the first time. It's a book that changed my life. It's a book that changed my whole perspective on life, and so what greater way to celebrate that testimony than by writing books with the objective of bringing people back to the scriptures? And that's what it better do. I mean, if somebody's using it to replace the scriptures, then that would be a mistake, and it would be a bad thing to have written the book. But if they're being led to the scriptures themselves, to read them on a regular, habitual, nightly basis, whenever they decide to read, then I would say mission accomplished.
We want to talk with you a little bit more about what's happened ever since you've published that first Ten Issues Among the Nephites, the last few years, and then talk about what's coming up with you. And we're going to do that all coming back here in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
That's right. We're back in the Cultural Hall, and it's the third block. We were able to get him to stick around with us. He had packed a whole day, you know, a day adventure to go to Frost Cave. He wanted to visit some old friends, Helam and Moroni and a bunch of people. But we got him to stick around and stay with us. It's Chris Heimerdinger, the author of the Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites series and other things. But we wanted to pick up. We'd got to the point where, you know, you've published the first Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites. So then what happened? I mean, you said you're able to make your living off of it.
Yeah, well, not for a few years. It's like the very first year didn't sell as well as the second year. And then the third year, the book, the original book in the series, sold better than the year before. I came out with my second book, Gadiens and the Silver Sword. And then it was interesting. I came out with my third book, Eddie Fantastic, and my new release sold as well as my old book, Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites, that particular year. So the series continued to gain momentum, and I kept thinking, you know, isn't this thing about over? And
yeah, can we be done with this? I want to write something else.
Well, you know, and people who are familiar with the Tennis Shoes series, sometimes they get a little bit surprised. They go to the second book, and it's like, what? They're not kids anymore? It's a total different phase of their lives, and the main character is somebody different sometimes. And that's more to keep me interested in what I'm doing than it is anyone else. I've got to be fascinated by the subject matter, and a lot of times I'm in a different phase of my life, and so I want to be able to explore that, and I may not be able to do it with a 12-year-old character. So that's been the fun part about being an artist with the Tennis Shoes series it's been limitless what I could explore and what I could talk about. And each individual book sometimes deals with not even the Book of Mormon, but the New Testament, or it deals with the Old Testament, or it deals with different phases or chapters in the Book of Mormon than what the original book did, and religion itself, sometimes church history. And it's complicated. Those who are familiar with the series know that new characters spring up and new storylines spring up, and I assume that there may be one or two books left in me for this particular series.
I was just going to ask you.
And then I'll just move on to something else.
So what do you think will be coming for those? Can you give us a little tease on what might be coming up in the future for those characters or for that series?
Well, the last book, which came out just last year, was Seers and Sorcerers. It's pretty much a story that's been carrying on as a singular story since my book, Warriors of Kimura. So it's like four books long now, the particular adventure that the characters are involved with. But I hope to close that up with the next novel, which will be called Thorns of Glory. And that's what I'm writing right now.
When do you plan on that coming out?
Oh, I have no plans.
No plans.
I can't plan these things. I wish I could. I'd probably have a more stable paycheck.
Yeah.
But, you know, so much of it is based on research. It seems like I've put a much higher bar on the level or quality of research with every single book. And so the new one is required more than anything because I'm dealing with both the battle at the Hill Cumorah and the last days in the life of the Savior in the same novel, as well as dealing with some events that take place in Jaredite times. So this is all in the same book.
Throw in the restoration and the apostasy and all that.
Feel comfortable with what you're doing.
Yeah. You should throw in, you got the restoration, toss that in there, and the apostasy of the church, put that in. Just all-encompassing part of that book then.
Well, I can only spread myself so thin.
I'm just kidding.
You know, if the story stays exciting for me, then I hope it stays exciting for the reader. And some have asked me, do you have this all mapped out? Do you have it all outlined somewhere in a drawer somewhere? And the truth is, no. I totally make up this story as I go along. I may have some vague idea, mostly because of the storyline that the scriptures tell, of where the story will eventually go. But it has to. Storytelling, in a sense, has to be as exciting for me as the writer as it is for the reader. In other words, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen next or how the characters are going to get out of a certain circumstance. And I like writing that way because nobody can outguess me. I mean, I know that they can't guess what is going to happen in order to save the characters or get them out of a certain mess, because I genuinely had no idea when I wrote it, when I wrote them into that mess, how I was going to get them out of that. And I've had incidents where I would have to walk around the block for a week to figure out a plan that would be acceptable and make sense to the reader just to get them out of a circumstance which looked like it was going to be life-threatening. And I think it makes for some pretty fresh, fun writing to write that way. At the same time, it's very scary. I'm always convinced at the end of every book that's the last one. That's it. I can't do it anymore. It's too much of an emotional strain and creative strain to write that way. So yeah, it's a creative way to write, but it probably means you need more therapy.
Let me ask you this. Do you have a, you know, basketball players always have like superstitious things that they do before they go and play a game. Do you have like a thing that you do to get in the zone for writing, or can you just pick it up, you know, today I'm going to write for 20 minutes, or kids went down for a nap, I'm going to go write for a little bit, or how does the process come about for you?
Well, overall, I was going to just say I pray, the other thing I do is I think when you have a family full of kids and it's like older kids, they know better than to interrupt dad. However, you know, 4 years old and younger, they know they have a license to come in and interrupt dad at any time.
How many kids do you have?
So I have 11.
You have 11 kids?
11 kids. We have a newborn. So,
wow.
Wait. Hold on.
Production.
Maybe through the phone that didn't come across the way that I thought. 11 kids, really?
11 kids, right.
Wow.
And our newest one, Hunter, is about 5 months old.
Holy cow.
And your oldest is how old?
Our oldest is returned from his mission to the Ukraine. So he's 23.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
22.
How do you get any writing done?
Right.
Good question. What am I? Then I do shows like this, and I get no writing done at all, which is only torturing the fans, guys. You're just making them wait longer.
Well, it's the tease. That's what it is, Chris.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
How do you? I mean, holy cow, 11 kids. Let me continue to have that try and register. So, how do you find time?
My office is in my bedroom. And so I can write at midnight just as easily as I can 6 a.m. And so I try, like any other job, to just do 8 hours. But obviously when there's pressure, you can put in more time like that. And when there's some family crisis, you put in less time than that. So, you know, and I hope it all averages out at the end of my life to be about 8 hours a day. But I have no idea what it is. And there's always sideline things. Like at the same time that I'm writing, I'm trying to raise money for another film. I directed a film back in 2008 called Passage to Zara, or it was released in 2007, called Passage to Zarahemla.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make a second movie based on a novel that we did called A Return to Christmas.
And will you direct that as well?
Yeah, I mean, why not? That's why I kept the rights. I've actually sold it twice. Once was to a company in Canada called Alliance. And the second one was to a man named Stan Margulies, who was the producer of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the original one done in the 70s.
Best one.
Yeah.
Birds. Anyway, so those two entities at one time held the rights to Return to Christmas, but both times it fell through and the rights fell back into my hands. And I've had a couple of offers since then, but I've rejected them all, saying, you know, I'm becoming interested in being involved with movie making
and storytelling through image,
and do it myself. And so right now we're in kind of that very lonely phase called money raising.
Yeah.
and for this one, because it really Return to Christmas has more generalized Christian elements, and so it can be for a much wider audience. So we need more money so that we could have some A-rate actors to attract rights. Foreign rights and distributor rights throughout the world. And so that's a whole different business game.
Well, if you need a bottom of the barrel local Salt Lake actor, you got me.
And me.
Well, we'll have to have you come in and audition.
Oh,
who knows what's going to happen with this project? I know that my partner in the project is based out of L.A.
Oh, wow.
And so that's and he's the money raiser guy. He's more of the business end guy. I'm the magician in the back room who really should only be all bothered by one or two people. I want to be the creative end and let somebody else handle the business end.
Yeah.
And this arrangement's working out pretty well so far. He's getting us in front of some big players in a week or two. But anyway, if that comes to pass, then yeah, I would want to direct it. There's no more addicting art form than making a movie. Orson Welles called it the greatest toy ever made, a camera, and I think that that's probably true. It's just a fun way to tell a story. I mean, it's a totally different art form than writing, but mm-hmm. it's still storytelling. And all of the same elements of suspense and keeping people on the edge of their seats and inspiring are all the same. But the way that you obtain that objective is completely different.
And would you ever consider directing something that is not LDS, like the subject matter isn't LDS-based? Would you want
to... Well, Return to Christmas is in that category. It never really talks about it being LDS-based at all within the context of the story. In fact, it's my singular book that I've published nationally. It was published by Random House in the 90s and the first part of the 2000s. And then they took it out of print around 2005, I think, and the rights came back to me. And the book itself is back in the hands of the original publisher, Covenant Communications. They published it originally, and then it went to Random House. Now it's back with them. But anyway, the rights to make the movie I've always retained or maintained on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're pursuing. And that's one sideline project that I'm pursuing. Seems like I always have something on the side that keeps my energies going.
Of all the things that you've done, movies, the different books, what's your favorite project that you've done? Or is it something that hasn't been done yet?
You know, that would be an interesting question to answer, because favorite, that could be interpreted by me personally. What's the favorite thing I've done?
Yeah, what's your favorite?
Or what's the best-selling thing, which means the favorite thing for fans. Probably the favorite thing that I have done is the thing that I'd be least known for. And that is, I did the songs, the music for Passage to Zarahemla, and it was released as an album called Whispered Visions. And you can still find it, I think, in some LDS bookstores, but most people order it directly from me.
So you wrote the score to the movie?
Well, no, I didn't write the score. The score itself was written by Sam Carden, and a lot of people will know that name.
Yep.
But the songs from the movie were written, and many of them were sung by me.
Wow.
And there's no art form that I've ever been involved with which is more satisfying than creating music. Why? Because I can enjoy the product as much as anybody who buys it. Whereas with a book, I can never enjoy reading my own books. I know how they're all going to end.
Yeah.
And the same with the movie, I suppose. But a song, you can enjoy with the same level of enjoyment as any fan, any consumer. And so that was probably the most satisfying thing that I've done, with the 9 songs that I wrote, some of which are featured prominently in the movie Passage to Zarahemla, and some of which may only be some of the music from the song that's in the movie. And you can only really get the song by purchasing the album. But that, I would think, is probably the funnest thing I've ever done.
What's been the best received by people? You say the favorite could be...
probably the best-selling singular book that I've ever written was probably A Return to Christmas. Or the Tennis Shoes series, if you just want to talk about the whole series as a whole, and maybe the first Tennis Shoes book. Those are the most successful projects that I've ever been involved with as far as... I can't complain, because those were the two books that were given to me in a dream. And so maybe I should listen to my dreams a little more often, because those were the two that were the best-selling and the most successful and provided, I guess, the most revenue to feed my family. Doing music, I would love to be able to jump back into that. and get involved with that. But it's it doesn't pay the bills as much as writing books. I'm just not known for that. In fact, you're probably learning it for the first time.
Yeah.
So, but that album is very well received by those who find out about it and read it, and then they do pass it along, and I get orders for it just on my own online systems. And I haven't even made it available for iTunes or anything like that. I'm not quite as savvy as some with regard to the new opportunities in the computer world.
Yeah.
And so it's still only available on CD. I think you can download it, actually. I think it is downloadable on frostcave.com.
Can I get it on cassette tape?
Can you get it on tape? No,
yeah,
you can't
cassette
get it on
tape.
Cassette.
No, okay.
Every now and then, I do get people who still want the older, some old versions of the Tennis Shoes series on cassette, and got to tell them they're out of print.
Yeah.
You can't get those anymore.
Who makes a cassette?
And some people are heartbroken.
Let me ask you this: as I was doing the research about about you and coming into this, a couple of years ago, there was a story about call it an incident. I want to say 2006, talking about misdemeanor mischief.
Well, I was divorced in 2006. Yeah, I think it was 2006. I think that it didn't come through till 2007.
Yeah,
there was some back and forth. Boy, you guys really aren't based or associated directly with the LDS Church.
No.
If you're just interested in news or background, then yeah, there were some family squabbles and such that took place, and one of them made the news, and I know it even made X96 because they were talking about how I kicked open a door or something. It's like, no, that's not even what happened. It was an accident where the door... Anyway, it doesn't even matter, and I'm not even sure I want to go into the details
okay.
of all of that. But, I was divorced in 2006 and got remarried in, I don't know, it's been 2 years, so do the math. And we just had a child, and that's probably where you get the 11 kids, because six of them are mine, and mm-hmm. five of them were hers. So
oh, okay. Okay.
I basically doubled my family.
Yeah.
As a result of getting remarried. And no regrets. That's exactly what I was supposed to do.
Yeah,
well, that's great. So we ask everyone that comes in the cultural hall a few questions. So we're going to ask you the same thing. What is your calling in your ward right now?
I just got moved out of teaching Sunday school to teaching primary. So my wife and I are co-teachers together, teaching in 7-year-old primary.
Oh, fun! What age were you teaching in Sunday school?
I was teaching the 13, 14-year-olds.
So you went from 13, 14 to 7-year-olds.
Right.
How receptive are those 7-year-olds?
What's interesting is I never grew up in this church, so much of the primary experience has kind of floated over my head over the years because I keep getting put in teaching positions or in elders' quorums or things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've never really had a calling in the primary. And so sitting there in the primary classes has been unique for me. I've never done that. I've heard some of the songs, of course, as my kids come home over the years, and now and then you go in and visit and you listen to your child give a talk. But becoming as immersed as this probably was a good thing because I really didn't have any idea how the primary worked.
If you could pick your calling, you could pick a calling, say that it worked that way, what would you pick?
What would I pick if I were to pick my calling? I think I would love to be anything above bishop. Because all they have to do is talk. It's like Marky Peterson said once, above bishop, it's all talk. And that's fun. There's no real challenge of people hating you because you cut them off the welfare program. above bishop, you're basically just in a position where everybody thinks you're the smartest guy and the most spiritual man in the whole stake or in the whole region or in the whole church. And I hope that it only means that you're simply the best, one of the best communicators and organizers, being able to make the church grow and function on a macro level. Is that right? Macro?
Yeah,
micro and macro. On a macro level, to help the church grow and function and expand And I think that would be fun. I enjoy that so much when they get to the statistics report. I'm just one of those kind of guys. Every April they talk about how the church is growing, how many new wards, how many new stakes, all the new mission presidents, all the new missions, how the mission force throughout the world is expanding. I really enjoy watching that and seeing it, and seeing the church prosper throughout the world. And so, obviously, I'm interested in Mitt Romney, and I watch his progress and what he's doing every day,
mm-hmm.
in the hopes that he'll become the Republican nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the reasoning for that is simply I'm really interested to see what it does for the church. If this man becomes president, and nobody's talking about this, by the way, it's like in a sense. LDS people aren't talking about it because it's unlucky or something.
Yeah. We don't want to jinx it. We don't want to jinx it, Chris.
Yeah, we don't want to jinx it, right, by talking about it. But if someone like a Mitt Romney were to become the president of the United States, you'd have people in Chad, in small villages, who were suddenly contemplating, now, what is the religion that the American president belongs to?
Right.
And they would be. It would be an extraordinary thing for the LDS Church. And I hope it would be an extraordinary thing for America. But, you know, I'm not a campaign promoter.
Sure.
I'm just simply an observer.
But we've seen the Romney for President sign in your front yard. So we're
Yeah, well, I hope there is. The only sign that I have is, and I've only done this once in my whole life, I have a bumper sticker on the back of my car that says, I was anti-Obama before it was cool. And that's the only political statement in public that I've ever made.
There you go.
Anyway, and so I suppose that would be my attitude as far as the presidency is concerned. Anybody but Obama. But it would be so fascinating to see how it affects the church if someone like Mitt Romney were to be elected.
I agree.
So finally, what we ask people to do is to climb up on the Ramyumptum and tell people where they can find your books, where they can get in contact with you if they want to, if they want to hear that music or any of that stuff, any websites, Facebook, that kind of stuff. Where can people get in touch with you?
Sure. I'm on Facebook. That can take up so much of your time if you let it. And so if you give me a message on Facebook, it might be a few weeks before you get a reply. But you can get all the information that you need from www.frostcave.com, that's where I sell my stuff, or www.frostcave.blogspot.com. That's where you can contact me and tell me what you think, and that's where I write articles and sometimes advertise books and basically just philosophize about life or Book of Mormon geography or whatever it is that I happen to be wanting to philosophize about. So those are two of the best places. But, I mean, I have the easiest email to remember in the world, just cheimerdinger@gmail.com. And over the years, thousands and thousands of fans have contacted me that way, and I respond to every one of them. And we'll see what the viewership of your what the listenership of your podcast is as a result of giving out that information. But I don't mind. It's something that I have to feel almost obligated to do. I mean, if I was Elvis, it would become too overwhelming.
Sure.
And I wouldn't be able to do it. But just as a Latter-day Saint artist, it's fun to be able to converse directly with fans, find out how they feel, find out what they're thinking. And sometimes when I'm in a down day and I just have to listen to somebody gush about how much they love the Tennis Shoes series, that can really lift my spirits too, because it's a very lonely job,
mm-hmm.
being a writer. All you're doing is sitting in front of a blank computer screen trying to figure out what words to put down. And so the computer can sometimes be your only real contact with humanity on a given day. So anybody would be welcome to contact me for whatever reason.
Well, thank you very much for being here with us in the Cultural Hall, Chris. We hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body.
And when the time comes, you will all travel home safely.
And in the meantime, we will be saving a seat for you
on the back row
of the Cultural Hall.